好嘞，大和尚说，囊拉忙一把塞的过些嘞，但囊拉忙个把塞的，那让的鱼囊的囊鱼等，但煮鱼塞的，只当塞把了鱼的嘞，囊鱼煮鱼你用过了哇？你囊呢？但让给煮鱼的，煮鱼了，俺这样让菜，我不去说，让鱼煮鱼我不明白去，呀，俺就烧完囊，对起那嘛，这我烧完囊，烧完囊呢，俺得了，俺应该把这美女皮给。And the Sheva Tila, the Nana Mangulo, like the S. Casano, Nana Mulu, who was it in this room, or this year one? That dinner by Yolmas and Tisin Sheva, and that Nana Mulu Tila, the one she succubi, Nana Mangulota, and he she succubi, Nana Mulu, he wants to keep an animal, Losi, Niungre, or the Yolmason. Nije. One should you be Nanama Lochi, the Yungus, Nanama Lochi,
Yungu. Good morning. So last night we spoke about, we looked at the non-ascertaining awarenesses. And so we saw that the definition of a non-ascertaining awareness on the top of page 13 is a knower that has a common basis of having a clear appearance. Of the specifically characterized phenomenon, that is, its engaged object. So here we saw that if it has a clear appearance of its object, it must be a direct perceiver. And the specifically characterized phenomenon means that it's impermanent. And the reference was made directly to an engaged object. And so consciousnesses in general will have an appearing object and an engaged object. And continuing in the definition, we saw that a non-ascertaining awareness also is unable to induce ascertainment, in other words, memory, with respect to the impermanent phenomenon, that is, its engaged object. And then we looked at divisions of non-ascertaining awarenesses, which aren't mentioned in the text. So those divisions are sixfold, the five relating to sense direct perceivers, and the sixth, relates to mental direct perceivers. So for each of the different sense direct perceivers, there's a potential non-ascertaining awareness, so making five, and then the sixth being for mental direct perceivers.
And it's a matter of just saying, Nala Mangaba says, Shiro. Just other Nala Mangaba says, Shiro, do one be almost on the Gibi Nala Mamba Loyabache. Ye almost on the Gibi Nala Mamba Loyabache. Rari was on Gibi Nala Mamba Loyabache. Da Nala Mulutilla Midawaka Zeros, Sum Chai, or ye washes Gibi Nala Mamba Lochiche. Ye shes Gibi Nala Mamba Lochiche. The Rari was on Gibi Nala Mangaba says, Chiche. Then Najum was on Della Nala Mamba Loyamare says, Shiro. That is Najum was on Della Nala Loyamare says.
Another way to look at the divisions of non-ascertaining awarenesses would be, because a non-ascertaining awareness, as we've seen in the definition, can only relate to direct perception. So if we go back to direct perceivers on page 3 and 4 in the text, we see that direct perception has four divisions. Of those four divisions, non-ascertaining awarenesses are to be found, as we've just heard, amongst sense direct perceivers. So all of the five sense direct perceivers have a potential for non-ascertaining awareness. We see that in the middle of the page, number 3, non-ascertaining awarenesses that are sense direct perceivers. Also, if we look over at mental direct perceivers, we see that there are mental direct perceivers that can be non-ascertaining awarenesses. Again, the third division. Below that, self-knowing direct perceivers. Third division again, non-ascertaining awarenesses. So in this way, we can say that there are three different types of non-ascertaining awarenesses relating to the first three of the four direct perceivers. Over the page, the fourth type, yogic direct perceivers, these do not have non-ascertaining awarenesses because of the power of the yogic direct perceiver.
I didn't want to Dinma shared it. I want to be Kissing Mosum Jabba, Jesse, Yijuan, Nalama, Tisum, Roche, Lurik, Dui, Chibi, Naneda, and Gadi, Shi Diba, Tarte, that in it, Gasuri, Mosum Jabba, Jesse, Yijuan, Nalama, but Tarte, that then Tisum, you got shared, Tisum, Kurwa.
amongst the sevenfold division of awareness and knowers, we've now looked at five of them. The first was direct perception and inferential valid cognition. So those we looked at some time ago. And then last time we looked at sense, subsequent cognition, correct assumption, and now non-ascertaining awarenesses. So that makes five. And we come now to doubt being the sixth, and wrong consciousnesses later will be the seventh of the sevenfold division of Lodic. Wanting to know what is meant by doubt, what is the entity of doubt, we turn to its definition. A knower that wavers between two alternatives by its own power. So this is halfway on page 13. Doubt being defined then as a knower that wavers between two alternatives by its own power. The expression here, two alternatives. So this is refers to doubt is not settled. Doubt then is a consciousness that is wavering between two possibilities. For example, seeing a shape in the distance, so seeing form in the distance, doubt is the consciousness that wonders, is that a person or not? Perhaps it's a person, perhaps it's a tree trunk. So here we see doubt wavering between the two alternatives of, is that form a person or perhaps something else such as a tree trunk? This is the meaning of wavering between two alternatives. When it comes to this sixth of the sevenfold division of Lodic, we actually hear a different division of awareness and knowers, which we'll come to in some weeks' time, is introduced. And that is the division of consciousness into main minds and mental factors. So this gets introduced here. Or every main mind or primary consciousness is accompanied by other consciousnesses, which are called mental factors. Doubt itself is not a primary consciousness or a main mind, but is one of many mental factors. So we'll see later when we come to this division in a few pages' time that there are 51 mental factors present, of which doubt is only one. So doubt, as we've just seen in the division, is a mind that wavers between two alternatives. So the question then comes, what about the main mind that doubt accompanies? That also is wavering between two alternatives. So is that also therefore doubt? And what about the other mental factors that accompany that main mind, of which doubt is one? They all also waver between two alternatives. So are they to also doubt? So for example, the mental factor of feeling. Does that, or feeling, or can be translated as sensation. Does this, as this also wavers, is it doubt? And in brief, the answer is that's not the case. Whilst these minds are knowers, they are not doubt, but they are knowers, they are consciousness, but they are not doubt. Doubt, the mental factor of doubt, of course, is a doubt. It wavers between two alternatives. The mental factors, the main mind that doubt accompanies, as well as the other mental factor that doubt that accompany that same main mind, whilst they too waver between two alternatives, they are not doubt. For example, the mental factor of feeling is not doubt. And the reason for that, whilst all these, this main mind, the one main mind, and its accompanying mental factors, its concordant mental factors, all waver between two alternatives, only the one mental factor, being doubt, is doubt, and that is because doubt alone wavers between two alternatives under its own power, or as we see in the definition, by its own power. The main mind and the accompanying mental factors, whilst they waver between two alternatives, they don't do so under their own power, rather they waver between two alternatives by the power of doubt itself. So doubt influences the main mind as well as the other concordant mental factors to waver between two alternatives. And therefore, the mental factor of, say, feeling and the main and its accompanying main mind, these, whilst wavering between two alternatives, do not do so under their own power, but under other power, namely the power of doubt.
Tezum yutup yutup var ya sade. Ben de sigurat de ngandu modaj lamgan pa modaj tur sen shu che pa jo sha de di yin di wa xin lo ma yue ba na modaj pa jo sha de xin lo ma de yu ru ru a je sa di xin lo ma de jo wa de ga de jin ne koron rang dup ju jo wa re ba la ne ko rang dup ju jo wa ma re ga sen modaj de do de di shu gi pa tian jo ru wa da xin lo ma de tian ju bo ru wa je sa di xin lo ma de modaj ju ru de 新罗马的 做先达的那些现在写不了的车上，俺朋友多过十个的，因为呀，让都给多过啥嘛的，俺车上一点都不多过啥话的，别那毛这个手机顶个新罗马的天主吧，那些嘛几把的，现在别说是的，吃不着。
When doubt is wondering, is that form I see in the distance a person or something else or not a person? Doubt itself, that mental factor, it has this quality of wavering between two objects and is doing so through its own power. The main mind that it accompanies, as well as the other concordant mental factors, these two are wavering between two alternatives, but not due to their own power, rather due to the power of doubt. So this can be likened to when one is driving, possibly quite quickly. The car is, of course, moving. So too are the leaves and the flowers on the side of the road. They also move as the speeding car goes past. But the car is moving under its own power, but the leaves and the flowers on the side of the road are not moving under their own power. They're moving under the power induced by the speeding car. So similarly, whilst the main mind and the other mental factors also waver between two alternatives, they are not doing so under their own power, but rather under the power or the influence of the mental factor of doubt.
This
point is emphasized here because by now it's clear that consciousness can be divided in many differing ways. And what we're seeing here is that doubt has the power to influence the minds that accompany it, whether they are the main mind or the mental factors. So there can be confusion that when doubt arises, all the other minds that are or all the other consciousnesses that accompany it are, as they also waver between two alternatives, are they not all then also doubt? And so this point is here emphasized for clarity, that whilst doubt influences, or under the power of doubt, it's the main mind it accompanies, as well as the other concordant mental factors. Whilst they waver between two alternatives, they do not do so under their own power, but due to the power or the influence of doubt. What I've been presenting here is now illustrated in the paragraph beneath the definition. A main mind that is concordant with doubt and the feelings, etc., that which are accompaniers of the main mind. So just to say something here on translation, in the context of main mind and mental factors, the word mind and main mind are synonymous. In general conversation, the word mind and main mind are not synonymous. So here, we're talking in the context, for the first time, of main mind and mental factors. So when we see mind, we can understand that this means main mind. Or it's another synonym for main mind, because this is new for us, is primary consciousness. So a main mind that is concordant with doubt and the feelings, etc. So here, etc., this refers to other mental factors. So feelings is not a main mind, but is a mental factor. And etc. refers to all the other feelings. So such as so feelings is one of the omnipresence mental factors. So all this we'll come to, but feeling is one of them. The others are discrimination, intention, mental engagement, and contact. So all of these mental factors, under the influence of doubt, waver between two alternatives. But they are not doubt because they are not doing so under their own power.
We
have three divisions to doubt. Doubt tending towards the factual, doubt tending toward the non-factual, and equal tending
doubt.
The illustration for the first type of doubt, that's tending towards the factual, doubt reflecting that sound is probably impermanent. So the reason why doubt reflecting that sound is probably impermanent is an illustration of doubt tending towards the factual, is because this is a doubt that is going in the correct direction, that is going in the factually concordant direction, or the correct direction rather. So sound is of course impermanent, and so the doubt is going in the direction that is maybe you could say in accordance with reality, that is factual. Another easy illustration to understand is if, let's say, you're in the park and your dog that you're walking is playing in the distance with other dogs which look of the same breed and look identical, and then of that group of identical looking dogs playing together, yours or one starts running towards you. Now, still a little bit far, you're not entirely sure whether it's your own dog running towards you or one of its friends. So you think, oh, it probably is mine. But you're not sure because it's a little bit far, they all look the same. But because it actually is your dog, therefore, this is a doubt tending towards the factual. And it's towards the factual because it is your dog. And it's a doubt because you lack certainty. Your mind is wavering between two alternatives. In the same illustration with the dog, so the dog is running towards you and you think, I don't think that's my dog. So here it's a doubt because you're not certain. I don't think it's my dog. So now it's just a doubt, but which of these doubts is it? Well, it is actually one's dog, but one is thinking, I don't think that's my dog. So this is then an illustration of the second type of doubt, that which is tending towards the non-factual. So here one is going in the mistaken direction, thinking that this dog that is coming towards me, it looks like my dog, but I don't think it is, when it actually is one's dog. So that's an illustration of doubt tending towards the non-factual. With the dog approaching one, because of the distance and that they being the same breed, one thinks, I wonder if that's my dog. I really have no idea. So this then would be an illustration of equal tending doubt. Because one is not going one's doubt is not going in a particular direction, which could either be in the correct direction or a mistaken direction. So one really hasn't a clue. And this then is equal tending doubt.
And so that understanding, we can understand very easily then the illustration of with sound. If one is then thinking whether sound is impermanent or not, and if one's so this is a doubt because one is wavering between two alternatives, and so one's thinking, is sound impermanent or not? And if one is coming to the conclusion that yes, sound probably is impermanent, then this doubt
is going in the direction of how things are. So therefore, it is a doubt tending towards the factual. But if one's analysis, one is going in the opposite direction, thinking that, actually, I think sound is probably permanent, then one's doubt is going in the direction of how things are not. And then this is a doubt tending towards the non-factual. Whereas if one really isn't yet decided, one needs to think about it more, gather more knowledge, then one is thinking, I wonder if doubt is permanent or impermanent. And one can't get beyond that. One's not ready to go beyond that. Then that is an illustration of equal tending doubt. You may wonder why the illustration of sound is so often given as it is here. According to some non-Buddhist philosophies, sound is actually seen as permanent, something that does not momentarily change. So there are those philosophers that who believe that sound is permanent, and that is how sound exists. This, of course, is not the Buddhist view. Buddhists hold that sound is impermanent because it's dependent on causes and conditions. It comes about in dependence on causes and conditions. And therefore, it's impermanent, meaning it changes momentarily. And the reason, then, that sound is used as an illustration is because from the perspective of the attainment of liberation or enlightenment, one needs to develop an understanding of a correct philosophical view, a view going in the direction of reality, a view going away from the direction of confusion, of error. So therefore, if one has the thought, doubt is probably impermanent, then one's doubt is going in the direction that is in accordance with how things are, and therefore it's factually doubt tending towards the factual. Whereas if one's doubt is going towards, I think sound actually is permanent. What I've heard from this non-Buddhist philosophy, I think that's correct. So your view is going in the direction of the non-factual, which means it's going in the direction of greater error. So this is why the illustration of sound is so often used. These non-valid awarenesses we've been looking at. First, we looked at correct assumption, and last night, non-ascertaining awareness, and now doubt. These we have a lot of. They are consciousnesses that we have great familiarity with. So, taking this illustration, you know, this type of consciousness we look at now, that of doubt, these we have regularly thinking about, what shall I do? What is the best course of action to do in this particular situation? If I do this, possibly it will have these ramifications. If I do that, it may have those ramifications. What is the best to do? Or if we're going to embark on a particular project or engage in something, we're thinking, I wonder if I'm qualified to do this. I wonder if I have developed the necessary skills to be successful at this or not. Or if you're thinking we need help, who should I approach for help? Who should I hire to help in the situation? This person or that person or that person? I'm not so sure. So we have lots of doubts, as well as non-ascertaining awarenesses, as well as correct assumptions. So these are consciousnesses that we have a lot of familiarity with. With these three non-valid consciousnesses that we have so frequently, correct assumption, non-ascertaining awarenesses, and doubt, these have in common is they don't realize their object. Because very clearly, if one is doubting between two alternatives, wavering between two alternatives, clearly one hasn't realized the object. Likewise with correct assumption, it was controvertible, the object wasn't realized. It may be correct, but the object's not realized. And likewise with non-ascertaining awareness, very clearly the engaged object isn't realized. And the effect of this is that not having realized the object, there is a very real possibility or probability of an error being made. So this we know from our own experience in our daily lives when we have doubt. Should I do this? I see a problem. I see several courses of action. I see advantages to each and potential faults of each, so I'm not sure what to do. So here we see, we haven't realized the situation correctly. We do not have a direct perception in relation to whatever the object is we're thinking about. So therefore, there is the very real possibility that whichever activity we decide to engage in, or decide not to do anything at all, that unwanted consequences may follow. Problems may follow, unwanted situations, errors may follow. So this all comes from our consciousness not being a direct perceiver or a inferential valid cognizer or a correct assumption. Those three have realized their objects. Direct perceivers, inferential valid cognizers, subsequent cognition. Those three have realized their object. So then one proceeds in an unmistaken manner, in a correct manner. Whereas when we're relying on correct assumption or doubt, and then also similarly non-ascertaining awareness, the object hasn't been realized. So here we are quite likely to encounter problems and difficulties. So therefore, the purpose of understanding Buddhist psychology or Lodic, awareness and knowers, is to understand our own psychology, our inner working so much better, and come to understand the ramifications of relying on consciousnesses such as doubt and correct assumption and non-ascertaining awarenesses, that we need to proceed with caution. Be aware that we have not realized the object. Don't hold too strongly to that, to the decision we've come to. Moreover, we need to keep developing our wisdom so that we can realize the objects and thereby give rise to inferential valid cognition or direct perception, because then we can proceed with confidence. From the perspective of our Dharma training, our mental development, so where we have a doubt, if it is factual or tending towards the factual or tending towards the non-factual, is of great importance. Because if we have a doubt and it's tending towards the factual, so it's, we're not mistaken, then it's okay to follow in this direction and keep going in this direction. But if we're coming to a conclusion that is actually that is non-factual, then error will follow, problems will follow, our mistaken understandings, our wrong views will strengthen and develop. Being mindful of our inner workings, seeing when we have a doubt, we then need to use this as a sign. We need to investigate further. We need to analyze further. We need to rely on more knowledge and more analytical investigation based on that knowledge. Because that is the process by which one goes from doubting to a correct assumption to actually finally realizing the object. So to use this easy illustration of whether sound is impermanent or not. So we may have heard of you that sound is permanent and it always abides, and therefore it doesn't change momentarily. So that is a view. Then we hear the Buddhist view that says, no, sound always comes about in dependence on causes and conditions, therefore it disintegrates and it's impermanent. So we hear conflicting views. We need to gather more knowledge and investigate for ourselves, think, analyze. And when we come to the point of through relying on a correct reason, we come to realize the object. So, and that is then an inferential valid cognizer. We have then realized the object, which means our view is in accordance with reality. We've gone from a view preceding to that, which was a correct assumption, which was in the direction of reality, it was correct, but we hadn't realized the object. Now we finally have, and that has come about through further analysis based on correct reasoning. So this is how we need to approach our Dharma practice.
Diane yano gomje ya ya gomjin, tene yang that the dame naidu, dunjida jene nangurwa, doye de dunjida jene naji dame, but dunjida jene doduro. Tene that do gomu gomu gomujin, tene gazam jilla, dunjida jawa the chasa beta meva chache, and the mosum doadu, didn't that you mosum se charurwa. A dusin jimbaros mas on a dusus to gorwa.
When we start to hear teachings on the Dharma, some things we will readily make sense to us, we'll readily accept. Others, it will lead to some confusion, and you won't really follow what's going on. And others may sound quite extraordinary, really claims that are very far from our own belief system. But as we continue to receive more teachings and reflect on these teachings, then we're developing some knowledge and some experience. So let's take the topic of selflessness. So usually before one has received teachings on selflessness, one hasn't really thought about how the self exists at all. It's not something that comes up in general conversation. And one certainly is unlikely to have thought about whether the self exists truly or not, because the concept of true existence also doesn't come up much in everyday conversation. So one hears about the presentation on the self, and then doubt arises. Is what is being said here correct? Is this just nonsense? Or is there some truth in this? So here we have a mind wavering between possibilities, thinking, is this presentation correct or not? And independence on repeatedly hearing teachings on the same topic and reflecting again and again on that same topic, then independence on reflection based on ever-growing knowledge, then some clarity starts to come. And in the context of selflessness, then hopefully, with these doubts arising, one investigates further. So at first, the investigation may have been not at all, or very weak, but as these doubts start to grow, do things exist in the way that they appear? Am I living an existence where I'm continuously deceived or not? As these doubts grow within us, we investigate further and further. They serve to spur our interest and our desire to understand reality, to lift the veils of confusion. But we're not really sure yet whether these veils of confusion are exist in the way that it's presented or if the teachings are mistaken. But we have some interest. So therefore, we have doubt, and we have, due to the interest, we continue to investigate. And our investigation is now based on ever more sound reasons because of receiving further and further teachings on the topic. So the illustration here is selflessness, but it applies to all the topics. So we then hear that the way to investigate is first to see how the object, for example the self or any object, appears to our conceptual consciousness. And we hear that it appears as if it's truly or inherently existent. And we hear that what that means is the object appears as if it is unchanging and independent. It can't be influenced by anything at all. So we hear this. We have some doubt because this doesn't necessarily accord with our experience. But we investigate. And through this process of over a sustained period, both hearing teachings and reflecting on these teachings, our doubt, which at first maybe is equal tending, we're not too sure, we're really a bit confused, but then we're starting to have greater knowledge, and we're starting to understand better, and therefore our doubt now is tending towards the factual. So we're starting to at least have some belief that yes, probably the way things appear is not how they exist. We continue with this process, and eventually come to a correct assumption. So that consciousness we looked at last time, and we saw there are differing divisions of correct assumption. So we eventually come to a correct assumption. So here, we no longer have doubt. We have certainty. Doubt has been eliminated. We're no longer thinking, probably the self doesn't exist in the way that it appears. Probably it is not inherently existent. Probably the self doesn't exist in this way at all, and therefore we are selfless. Now the probably has gone, and we have some certainty. We have certainty that the self does not exist in the way that it appears. In fact, no phenomenon exists in the way that it appears. We have certainty. So, we have a correct assumption. But we haven't realized the object. So we've overcome our doubt, but we haven't realized the object. So what that means is our mind is now no longer wavering between does the self exist in the way that it appears or not. We are certain it doesn't exist in the way that it appears. But this is a mind of correct assumption. It is controvertible. It hasn't realized the object. We continue with this process, hearing teachings, reflecting on these teachings repeatedly over a sustained period. And we've now already progressed beyond perhaps an equal tending doubt, beyond then a doubt tending towards the factual, to now a correct assumption. And as we continue, the strength of our understanding grows. The strength of our certainty grows. Eventually getting to the point where no longer have we not realized the object, to actually when we do realize the object. And here the difference comes in terms of the power of the realizing consciousness. The correct assumption is more powerful, of course, than a doubt. It has certainty, but it hasn't led to any transformation, any powerful or lasting transformation of one. So therefore it's quite weak when compared to an actual realization, the inferential value of cognition. That then is when the object, in this case selflessness, is realized. And that has a transformative impact. The object is now realized. Then, in the moment the object is realized, it's first, as we heard this term last night, the object of selflessness, when it's first realized, it's combined with the meaning generality of selflessness. So it's not a direct perception, but an inferential valid cognizer, because it's combined with its meaning generality. But this is a realization. The object now is realized and has a transformative impact on one. And the second and subsequent moments of that inferential valid cognizer is now subsequent cognition. These two are realize its object. So now we have a realization, but it's an inferential valid cognition followed by subsequent cognizers. Continue this process repeatedly over a sustained period, hearing more teachings, continuing to reflect, developing this realization that was an inferential valid cognition to the point where we directly realize selflessness, with the difference being, again, the mind is so much more powerful. And it's the power of this realization now is seen through how the object is now for the first time directly realized without any presence of a meaning generality. Before, it was combined with the meaning generality. Now, there's no meaning generality. It's a direct realization. And this then is a yogic direct valid cognizer. So this is the sequence going from doubt up to correct assumption, eventually then to inferential valid cognition, and eventually then to a yogic direct perceiver realizing selflessness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Then,
For a doubt on any topic to progress towards a direct perceiver is our goal. So on all the topics of the Dharma, as well as for our life to go well, if we are our understanding is correct, and to the degree that our understanding is correct and unmistaken, we are less likely to experience problems. And if we give rise to a direct perception where we realize the object, we know the situation unmistakenly, then we are going to be able to make right decisions, we'll have correct views. So the key point then, to get to a direct perception of any topic, is right back at this point of doubt, whether our doubt is tending toward the factual or tending towards the non-factual. And the problem we have, and you know this from your own life, is because we have doubt, because we are wavering between the alternatives, we don't know. We want to go in the direction of the factual, but we're not entirely sure of what the factual is. So therefore we tend to rely on advice from others. And we'll hear from others, this is the direction of the factual. This is the mistaken direction. This is the correct direction. We'll hear that advice, we'll think about that advice, and then we'll make a decision. Possibly, though, still with doubt. But this point here of deciding between what is the direction of the factual or non-factual is key, because we always choose to go in the direction of the factual, but we don't really know whether it's factual or not. So in our context of spiritual development, in the context of attaining liberation and enlightenment, here the decision is which direction to go in is of great importance because of the goal that can be achieved. And how to go in the correct direction, how not to go in the mistaken direction, is not something we can do on our own because we lack knowledge, we lack experience, we need to rely on others. So here, who we rely on is of great importance. We can take this then back to the beginning of our Lam Rim teachings. There, the Lam Rim teachings start with the importance of the spiritual teacher. Because if one relies on a spiritual teacher who teaches a mistaken path or a wrong path, we are going to be hearing many reasons why, for example, the self exists in the way that it appears. It is independent. It's always there. It's unchanging. It's not influenced by anything at all, and it's unchanging. Hearing many reasons establishing this, not hearing reasons for that don't establish this, we are likely to accept this. We're likely to accept these reasons. We will analyze, we'll investigate, but our knowledge base is flawed. And therefore, we are likely to come to a conclusion, yes, the self probably exists truly. The self probably exists inherently. So here we're thinking, oh, I'm still doubting, but it's tending towards the fact. But it's not. It's a doubt tending towards the non-factual. So here, previously, prior to receiving these teachings and following this teacher or tradition, one may have thought, oh, the self properly exists independently and is unchanging. But that wrong view was not based on reasons, and it was not based on analysis, which means it wasn't very powerful within us. It didn't have too much influence. Now, though, that we've heard many reasons for presenting the self as being inherently existent, and we've reflected and accepted those reasons, our view is very strong within us. And this then becomes an acquired view of self-grasping. So it's not only a wrong view, but it's acquired. So we have cultivated this within us. So this is a powerful wrong view within us. And we've come to develop this based on relying on a spiritual teacher who's teaching a wrong view. So from this we see why relying on a qualified spiritual teacher is of such great importance. The text then, in reference to doubt, presents the example of impermanent sound, or sound being impermanent or not. Then I've used the illustration of selflessness, whether the self exists or in the way that it appears or not. But this process that has been outlined here applies to all Dharma topics, as well as, of course, to one's everyday life. So, for example, when one comes to Buddhahood, when one comes to Buddhism, one may well have doubt about future lives. It's not something readily accepted in all society. Likewise, Buddhahood. Probably one won't even know what Buddhahood is, and therefore will have doubt as to what such a thing is when one first hears about it. And if one, those doubts either remain or get compounded due to hearing wrong views, not believing in future lives, not believing in the possibility of Buddhahood, it is very unlikely that one will make the required effort, or the effort that is required to reduce and eventually eliminate our afflicted minds, as well as to intentionally strive to accrue virtue. Because to change habits doesn't come easily. To develop a virtuous habitual way of thinking and overcome non-virtuous habitual ways of thinking requires diligence. It requires great effort. To make that effort, if one lacks a belief that in cause and effect, or in future lives, or in liberation from suffering, one's very unlikely to apply oneself with the required diligence. So therefore, doubt can create great obstacles for us, can prevent us achieving our potential. We can understand this very clearly in our ordinary life. If some friends, they want to embark on something, and we think it's pointless, it's just a waste of time, we're not going to involve. We'll say to them, go off, do your thing. This I see as a waste of time. I can't be bothered. And so here, maybe if they are wasting their time, doubt is tending towards the fact, and it's better we don't get involved. But in terms of our spiritual development, doubt can create severe obstacles, and in particular, prevent us from achieving our human potential. Furthermore, for example, one may well come to Buddhism not accepting the six realms, not understanding that happiness comes from specific causes, namely virtue, unwanted circumstances, problems, difficulty, suffering, also comes from specific causes, namely non-virtue. And as long as one doesn't accept this or has doubt about it, one is unlikely to change one's behavior because there'll be no reason to. One will not see any reason to. But if one hears a presentation from one's teacher that in the same way that from a specific seed with the right conditions, a particular plant will grow. Likewise, through accumulating virtue, happiness will follow. Through understanding causality, through understanding that in dependence on causality, things such as the six realms come about. Happiness comes from certain causes, suffering from certain causes. We will then start to have doubt about our own behavior. And as that grows, we'll start to have doubt about our behavior in terms of our way of thinking. So initially, for example, our society may say, in many circumstances, minds such as anger are justified. We have this view. Then we hear teachings that from anger, anger is an affliction, can only lead, therefore, to suffering. Anger is non-virtuous. It needs to be abandoned. Now a doubt comes towards our previously held view that sometimes anger is okay. And we start as we investigate to see that actually anger does not lead to happiness. It can only lead to suffering. Whereas love, we hear that this is a virtuous mind. And from love, happiness comes for ourselves and others. Then, through this accumulation of knowledge that is in accordance with how things are, we develop doubts, and through further reflection, we develop correct assumptions. Here we will now be striving to overcome our afflictions. We'll be striving to develop virtuous minds such as love. And in this way, on one hand, of course, we're progressing towards liberation and enlightenment, but we are also experiencing more happiness, transforming problems, creating less problems and difficulties. So here we see that from this process of having doubt, we gain interest to develop further knowledge, to gain more information, and through engaging in analysis or meditation based on that knowledge, we tend towards the factual. We tend away from mistaken views. And in this way, doubt serves as leading us towards correct assumptions and eventually realizations. But this process of going from doubt to correct assumptions and eventually inferential valid cognition comes about independent on relying on a qualified spiritual teacher so that our way of thinking and our knowledge base and our analysis based on that knowledge will take us in the direction in accordance with how things are and away from wrong views. So therefore, this section here on doubt is of great importance because it highlights the importance of a spiritual teacher. It shows the process of our spiritual development away from wrong views towards understanding reality on all topics, whether in our daily life or all the various topics of the Dharma. This is the process. This is the process. So whilst here we see it's just a few words, it's a very small section in our text, it's one of great importance. Now we come to the seventh of the sevenfold division of consciousness, that of wrong consciousnesses.
Wrong consciousnesses have the divisions we used to, or the outlines rather, definition, divisions, and illustrations. The definition then of a wrong consciousness at the top of page 14 is a knower that engages its object erroneously.
Rangyula
Another that engages its object erroneously. So this would be, for example, if we think back to being in the park and one of many similar looking dogs runs towards one, and one thinks either that, oh, this is my dog, when it's not, or one thinks, this is not my dog, when it is. So with a wrong consciousness, it engages with its object erroneously. So it takes something that is and sees it as is not, or something that is not and sees it as it is, being like that. So this is a wrong consciousness, engaging with its object erroneously.
Zambling go re zero, Tisanganzuki, Yaman Zambling, Tushiri, sometimes go married, go married, Tushiri, some big, some tea, thou loshe shatirua.
This process, as was just said, works in both directions. Something that is in a particular way, believing that it's not in that way. So that would be a wrong consciousness. And likewise, believing that something is not in a particular way when it is. I think I said the same thing, but it works both ways. So there are many examples. For example, a long, long time ago, it was widely accepted that the world was flat and probably square in shape, and this was widely accepted. But this is not how the world exists. The world, as we know, is spherical. So that, whilst at the time, was certainly believed. Now, most people believe that the world is not flat, but rather square. Oh, round. Sorry, my own view.
Dawa 두셔야 치료되는
And in ancient times, there were many, many such views. For example, I assume everyone here accepts that the moon circles the earth. And we know this, we've seen pictures, and it's well established. But before that evidence had been accumulated or disseminated, people had a variety of views as to what the moon was. So one I had heard when I was young was that a particular sentient being would regularly eat the moon, digest the moon, or take the moon into its mouth. And then prayers would have to be made so that a particular god would cut the head off that sentient being and thereby enable the moon to once again show itself. So this was believed by people in ancient times because they knew nothing else. So there were many of these kinds of wrong views that were prevalent in the past.
Again, then the meaning of wrong consciousness, we see it defined as a knower that engages its object erroneously, and this then can take something, believe something that is in a certain way and believes that it is actually in a different way. So that's, or to express this differently, to take an exist, something that exists, and believe that it doesn't exist. Or something that doesn't exist, and believe that it exists. So this is a wrong consciousness. And we have illustrations, many from the ancient past, and also ones, the famous one that will come up here in our text too, where believing that what one has seen is a rabbit with horns. So that, of course, is a wrong consciousness because one is taking a non-existent and believing that it exists. The horns of the rabbit are non-existent and one believes they exist. It's a wrong consciousness. So these are the kinds of, so when, in all topics of the Dharma, one tends to start with these illustrations, because they're very easy to understand, but they are, understanding them is not the purpose. The purpose is to take it to what, to the level of what is impeding our spiritual development. The wrong view that we have that impedes us greatly is taking the impermanent as permanent. So here it's good to be clear what is meant by impermanence and permanence in Buddhism. Impermanence means it changes momentarily. Permanence means it does not change momentarily. So we have this wrong view, and this is something that we grasp at repeatedly, grasping at the view of permanence. So we'll think of a situation and grasp at it as permanent, not being aware that the situation is impermanent. It changes momentarily. It will not last. But grasping at it as permanent can lead to grave suffering, because grasping at it as permanent means we think the situation will always harm us. Or conversely, grasping at something as permanent can lead to harm in other ways. We have this feeling that our lifespan, whilst we know it will come to an end, we grasp at our life as being permanent. We think we have lots of time. We make all these plans for the future. And in this way,
we waste our impermanent lifespan because we have not yet realized that our lifespan changes momentarily, and therefore not only will it end, it can at any time. So it's abandoning views, wrong views, such as grasping at permanence. This is the purpose of studying wrong consciousnesses. That was the definition, and then the divisions are twofold: conceptual wrong consciousnesses and non-conceptual wrong consciousnesses. The first type, conceptual wrong consciousnesses. There are many illustrations the text presents too. A conceptual consciousness apprehending sound as permanent. So it's a conceptual consciousness as thought, and it apprehends sound as being permanent. So that's a wrong consciousness. A conceptual consciousness apprehending the horns of a rabbit. And these are the two illustrations given, but there are many more.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong consciousnesses have two divisions, conceptual and non-conceptual. Non-conceptual, the second division, has two subdivisions, as we see. Mental consciousnesses that are non-conceptual wrong consciousnesses, and sense consciousnesses that are non-conceptual wrong consciousnesses.
他已经写被多面老师的开始讲说呢，米勒米基，我们不少啊，南美的米勒米写吧，是啊，这，我就说那，伊写吧的，现在米勒米呢，从那的泥土库的给米勒米的，从我们本来没多少人那个，这我们本来通的，我们一般，我们一般，我们呢，米勒米我们的，我们买的的。 那我们一般是啊，那啊，那东西是啊，那是东西的嘛，就啊，那啊，是吧？对那个南美的写法的，但南啊那些的这些是不一起写法，晓得吧？对，米勒米写法的，他一起写法的，他多没写法的，可是呢，你我们的东西的嘛，就啊，那啊，是啊，可是，告诉了多没写法，晓得不？现在对一起写法的，是啊，他一用写法的就多没老写的底下过了吧？清晰了，是吧？
So non-conceptual wrong consciousnesses have two subdivisions, the first being mental consciousnesses. So the illustration that's given, so 2.1, is a dream consciousness. So a dream consciousness is a mental consciousness, and it's a non-conceptual consciousness. A dream consciousness that clearly sees as blue the blue of a dream. So whatever the object is, it doesn't matter. One can be dreaming of flowers that are blue. So here we're talking about blue. So this color blue that we are dreaming of, it appears to the mental consciousness, which is non-conceptual, which means it doesn't have a meaning generality. Doesn't have a meaning generality. So therefore, it's a non-conceptual consciousness and a mental consciousness, a dream consciousness.
Don't make a shiva, 我们不听，我们不明白，那那些我们不了解嘛，是吧？就是说，我们不听，我们不那些，你来明我们不听，我们不那些，那就我们不明白，现在可落实的对，没明白就是明白，明白就可落实的。就是说，他一些吧，多没一些吧，落实松果的对，可松果的对，来起来。
Hearing then that a dream consciousness is non-conceptual may be surprising. So let's go through some points here establishing this presentation. So firstly, a dream consciousness is a mental consciousness and not a sense consciousness. So even though in one's dream, one appears to be seeing, for example, seeing objects of form, that dream consciousness is not a sense consciousness, even though one is seeing, for example, the flower, but a mental consciousness. And the reason for that is one is dreaming, one is asleep. When one falls asleep, all one's sense consciousnesses, they are not manifest, they absorb, maybe you can say, they absorb. So they're not manifest, only mental consciousnesses, the mental consciousness remains. So therefore, our dream is a mental consciousness and not a sense consciousness, because all the sense consciousnesses have absorbed. Withdrawn. Thank you. Withdrawn. So therefore, a dream consciousness is a mental consciousness. So that's the first point of three. The second is it's a non-conceptual consciousness and not conceptual because there's no meaning generality. Conceptual consciousnesses are always combined with a meaning generality. There is no meaning generality here in a dream, so therefore it is a non-conceptual consciousness. Then thirdly, why is it a wrong consciousness? And this is because, as we see in the illustration, it clearly sees as blue the blue of a dream. So it's seeing blue, but it's seeing it as blue, it's believing that it's blue. So therefore, it is a wrong consciousness. We'll stop here then for this morning. We'll just to briefly recap what we looked at doubt. So doubt, we heard that it wavers between two alternatives under its own power. And the key point here is to understand the divisions of doubt, that doubt can tend towards the factual, away from the factual, or be equal tending doubt. And that this is key to see, because if the doubts we have tend towards the non-factual, away from how things actually are, this will lead to more problems, more difficulties, wrong decisions, wrong views, etc. So therefore, it's important that whilst one has one requires doubts in order to come to a correct assumption and eventually a realization, we need to ensure that our doubts are actually going towards the fact, going towards in accordance with how things are. That is important, because in this way, we will be acting more in accordance with reality, even if we yet haven't realized the object. So that's the key point to take from doubt. And if you have some questions, then please feel free to ask.
Yes, I have a doubt about the definition of doubt. It seems to me that if it wavers between two alternatives, what actually it is, it's wavering between whether something is or isn't. In the examples you gave an example of you see a tree in the forest, it could be your wife or whatever. But actually, it's first of all, it seems to be a tree.
Mm.
And so your doubt is whether it's a tree or not. If it is actually taking two examples like that, then why not more than two?
Mm-hmm.
It could be a telegraph pole.
Yeah. So is the question then really about, is this two? Is it limited to two?
Is it limited to two? And are they really, is it that or not?
Yes. Yes. Okay. It is or not, or as opposed to, is it this, is it that? So two is's. Yeah?
Yeah.
No, not. Okay.
I mean, also with the impermanent and permanent, I mean, it could also be maybe sound doesn't exist. That's another possibility.
Okay. 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 Then he. Can answer both questions together. The way, to be more specific, the way the doubt arises is when one sees a form in the distance, a shape, and is wondering what that shape is. The thought will be, is that a person or not? Next, is that a tree or not? Is that a goat or not? So it's going, you're having one object appearing, and you're wondering, is it that or not?
then you have another object appearing. Is it that or not? So that's how it tends to appear. That's how it works. So we say, I wonder if it's a tree or a person or a goat. So we say three, but really the mind's thinking, is that a person or not? And if you think it's not, maybe it's a tree or not, but maybe it's not a person and it's not a tree, so maybe it's a goat. So you're going through is or not, is or not.
So there's subsequent cognitions that the doubt applies to.
Subsequent cognitions, which realizes what's been realized before. Or it realizes what's already been realized. So it sounds like they're differing doubts about that same object. I wonder if that object is this or not. I wonder if that object is this or not. So it sounds like it was three doubts about the same object. But they arise in the sequence of is or not. Is it a human or not? Okay? Thank you. Another question? At the back. Yes.
Could you say that in another way, that only one mental factor appears in the mind at one time?
Okay. Does only one mental factor appear with the main mind at the same time? Okay. Then to sem dang sem jung chik dang nam du jung ge de pe. Sem dang to sem dang sem jung chik dang nam du jung ge de pe. Sem jung chik 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 bu. Dang to sem chik.
Le to sem sem jung chik le nyum de to sem jing ma de ya ya ma ni su ma ya ma ni ya ma chi to sem jing ma de.
With every main mind or primary consciousness, there has to be a collection or a number of mental factors. The minimum are five. So when you come to mental factors later, we'll see that the 51 are divided into five groups, of which the first is omnipresent mental factors. And there are five within there, and those five are present with every main mind. So there are at least five. There may well be, and there are likely to be more. Okay?
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.